I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Looking at Boeing, Boeing burned through $3.93 billion in cash in the first quarter. That's a less dramatic drain than analysts had expected. So that's accounting for the stock moving higher as the embattled plane maker continues to slow output to get a handle on its manufacturing issues. So I guess trying to really focus on quality.
Right.
As opposed to quantity. George Ferguson, yep. He's been helping us along the way here with this Boeing story all along. He covers aerospace. He covers the airlines for Bloomberg Intelligence. He also is enjoying our Princeton campus
I'm
with
telling
the delicious
you, the satellite
lunch.
Show from Princeton is coming.
It's strong. Yeah, we're going down to Princeton.
Absolutely.
I mean, God forbid you take a train into the world's financial capital. George Ferguson doesn't have to do that. People come to George. George, talk to us about what we saw from Boeing in their results. What were the key takeaways for you?
So I think we saw not a lot. Not a lot of detail inside here about what matters most going ahead. We did see cash burn for 1Q, like you said, combined with CapEx, free cash flow usage, $3.9 billion. CFO had sort of told us that we would see something between $4 and $4.5 billion. It came in lighter than that. The markets, I think, are a little bit happier about that. But you can't live here long, right? I guess the big takeaway here, too, is that there's about $7 billion in cash and equivalents on the balance sheet. That's dwindling pretty quickly. They paid $4.4 billion, I think it was, in debt during the quarter. So something has to happen, right? They want to buy Spirit AeroSystems. I hear all kinds of conflicting reports, but essentially I think it's break. There's a lot of challenges around negotiating getting Airbus out of Spirit AeroSystems so Boeing can buy it. They've talked about using cash to buy Spirit, or I guess debt maybe. I think it's a company that doesn't want to add a lot more debt to their balance sheet. Spirit's market cap around $4 billion. You only have $7 billion left in the balance sheet. Something's got to happen. You got to raise some capital here. You can't do this all cash, or you got to use Boeing stock. And just the numbers, they're getting small, right? The cash numbers are getting small. You're running out of runway here. They need to come up with this plan with the FAA and how they're going to stabilize production, start building airplanes, start generating cash. Because you can't do this many quarters.
So, George, do you think that there's a risk that we could be hearing about some kind of financing activity from Boeing coming up? I mean, like you just said, I think it'd be kind of hard to envision them doing a debt sale right now. That sounds like a little bit of maybe a red flag to me. But if they would do, I don't know, the equity's not worth a whole lot. Like, what do you do from here?
Yeah, so agreed. I think, what I heard from you is that it could be hard to do a debt deal here. I think so. I mean, I think they wouldn't let $4.4 billion get repaid without sort of plumbing the markets and thinking about whether they would do an issuance here. But, you wouldn't want to raise equity here. I feel like it'd be hard to raise debt. You got a lot of money wrapped up in inventory on the balance sheet, airplanes that have already been built, haven't been delivered to customers. They've shipped some of those in the last quarter, which is free up some cash, but I think you really got to get the manufacturing process going again and generating cash that way. I think that would get folks more comfortable about giving more debt or equity.
I don't know. I could get a debt deal done in this marketplace.
You personally, Paul
Sweeney. Sure, I could go sell some Boeing debt back in the day if I had my seat back.
Maybe.
Some investment grade debt.
Sure,
saying.
No okay. problem.
All right.
George, talk to us about deliveries. Where are we today? I'm kind of focusing on the 757. That's kind of the main beast, as you've told us in the past. Where are we on deliveries today, and where do they want to get to, and do you have confidence they can get there?
Yeah, so I think we don't necessarily know where we are on deliveries today. We're going to find that out, I hope, on the earnings call here in a couple minutes. Again, I think that a number of the airplanes they delivered in March and in February were probably out of inventory that were already built. So, you know, what I'm getting back to is what the real build rate is. I've heard numbers in the 20s-ish. Where they want to be, they should be at 38, and they right now a month in the 737, breaking to 42, you know, near the end of the year, had they not had this problem with the panel blowout in the Alaska Airlines. So what I think we heard from the CFO at the Bank of America event, you know, conference earlier this quarter, in one quarter, sorry, 1Q, was that they want to be at 38 by the end of the year. Look, around 38, I think they were doing okay financially. They need to be breaking up into the 40s and 50s. That's going to make them a lot more healthy. That's going to make their supplier base a lot healthier. Spirit couldn't really survive down at that 30-ish, you know, 38 level of build rate. So again, I think where they want to be is up in, you know, up in the 40s and 50s where Airbus is. Airbus is getting ready to break into the, you know, 50s and 60s. They want to be up there, but they're, I mean, from a 50 rate, I think they're a year and a half away at least right now.
And of course, Airbus has just been like riding this whole Boeing disaster wave quite nicely to their benefit. So going well for our friends abroad over there. But you started off, George, by saying that, you know, there's not a whole lot to go off of here, that, you know, of course, Boeing didn't provide earnings guidance for the year. We've got some management changes coming up sometime within the year. We know that CEO Dave Calhoun is going to step down by the end of 2024. Do you think we'll get a little bit more guidance on that on the earnings call?
Not sure, right? I think that if we knew something about the next CEO, I think they probably would have even told us before the earnings call. That's such a huge overhang on this company right now, right? And I imagine, you know, we got this announcement. It seems like we move in dog years here at Boeing, right? One day is like seven anymore. I don't know. I think we got this a month ago, a couple of weeks ago. You know, I imagine there's a lot of work going on the search right now and feeling out constituents as to whether or not the folks they identify are the right people. So, and I think as soon as they know that they have someone in place, they'd announce it, because again, it's such a huge overhang. I think they need to get someone in place and they need to have their plan fleshed out and bring that to the marketplace as soon as possible. I think that's gonna create, again, a lot more comfort with investors. So I don't think they would hold that back. And I don't think that Dave Calhoun's gonna be the one that's gonna announce it either. And so I don't think anybody on the call would be a person announcing it, but I could be wrong. But I don't know that they're anywhere on that right now, and that's super important.
Hey, George, Boeing's customers, the big airlines, what are their needs these days? Do they need more aircraft? Like, if Boeing was at 50 or 60% production, would there be demand for that?
They need more, faster, you know, as soon as possible, I guess. Look, I think if you take United as a, you know, one of the core customers, you know, there's a demand to fleet refresh around the world, right? The new MAX is 15-20% more efficient than the old 737 or the A320. Airlines want that efficiency as soon as possible in their fleets. The market, I think, is looking fairly competitive. It may not, you know, this summer may be a little bit less competitive than we expected, given Boeing's problems and some of the geared turbofan problems at Raytheon that knocks some airplanes out of service. But fuel's rising, airlines want to be very competitive, they need the most fuel efficient aircraft, so they want them as soon as possible. And like in United's case, almost everybody is increasing size, right? Size of aircraft are rising because pilots got 20% plus wage increases. You got to find a way to drive down costs. One of the things we heard out of JetBlue yesterday, they're looking for ways to drive down costs. One of the things you always do is increase aircraft size, and therefore you're flying more passengers for the same, you know, cost of that pilot up front. That helps you improve efficiencies. They all want it. So they're all trying to find bigger aircraft to fly with more seats. And so, yes, airlines want airplanes as soon as possible. If you're a Boeing customer, what also really ticks you off is you look across the street at the folks flying the Airbus airplane, and they probably have little to no interruption this summer in their schedules. You're worried about what deliveries you're going to get and your ability to fly your schedule, and that hurts if you're the Boeing customer, right? The Airbus customers are smiling.
All right, George, thanks so much again for giving us an update there on the aerospace airline industry. George Ferguson, he covers all the airlines and aerospace for Bloomberg Intelligence.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Right smack in the middle of earnings season, I'll tell you, that was a very, very important earnings release and conference call last night for one Tesla. And it looks like Elon Musk got the job done. The stock's up 15% here today. Let's break down what we did see from Tesla and what we did hear from Mr. Elon Musk. We'll check in with Steve Mann. He's a global autos and industrials analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. He's down in Princeton, New Jersey. Very comfortable down in Princeton. He's not coming into New York. He's not taking the train. He's done all that malarkey.
But
he's
we
very
love the in-studio guests when we can get one.
Yes, and we need to go down to Princeton to our office. I got to show you that. It is awesome.
Especially with all of our BI friends down there.
I know.
We should do a remote broadcast
We're
going to
do
day.
That. I'll put that in the books. We'll go down there. They have great food, and that's where we built BI from day one. Hey, Steve, thanks so much for joining us here. What are your takeaways from what we saw from Tesla in the results and what we heard from Elon Musk?
Well, thanks, Paul. It's a sigh of relief, I think, for a lot of investors. You know, if you look at the valuation of Tesla, there's actually two groups. You can actually break it down two groups of investors. One who thinks it's just Tesla is just an automotive company. The other really believes in the long term, the AI, the autonomous vehicle. I think yesterday's call and yesterday's announcement, it soothes a lot of the concerns that both parties had yesterday, especially with the announcement that they're going to pull forward, not just launch, but pull forward the launch of the affordable EV.
Is that something that you give a lot of credence to, Steve? Because I feel like with Elon and with Tesla in the past, there have been these promises, and you know, maybe not all of them have quite come to fruition.
I think the affordable EV is a real thing. You know, like you guys talked about earlier, robotaxi. I think there's still needs time for development, but if you look at the affordable EV, it actually kills two birds in one stone. You know, it actually increases the scale. For Tesla, and you know, we're going to see revenue growth. We potentially see profit growth from the affordable EV, and that's exactly what the market needs. It's more affordable vehicles to increase penetration of EVs. The other thing that's really important with this affordable EV launch is it actually helps Tesla increase its reach globally, because you know, you have a lot of emerging markets that, you know, a lot of consumers there cannot afford an expensive $50,000 vehicle, $40,000 vehicle. So a sub $30,000 vehicle is the right product for them to expand geographically.
Steve, what do we know about the economics of such a new or lower cost vehicle? Can they produce that at a profitable basis on a per unit basis?
Yeah, there's a couple ways they can approach this. I think, you know, they can develop a totally new platform. But, you know, in the other segments I've done with you, we've talked about vertical integration. And vertical integration has actually reduced the cost of, you know, car production. So for them, you know, for Tesla, it's the only company that's profitable in producing EVs. So the other option is actually think about, you know, what they can do with the 3 and the Y. You know, can they offer, you know, lower trims, maybe even, you know, a smaller battery that's going to allow them to cut costs and also, you know, make that available to the consumer at a lower price.
So this obviously was the best part of the report. This is what the stock is rallying on right now. But you still had elsewhere in the earnings report, we had falling vehicle sales, we had worse than expected revenue and profit, and a pretty significant cash burn figure. So, I mean, Steve, are you totally optimistic here? What kind of concerns do you still have here?
I've always said, you know, I think this year and even into next year, there's some bumps on the road. You know, Cybertruck is still ramping up. It's a very difficult vehicle to build. They're still working on those issues. You know, we don't think the EV market, actually, especially in the U.S., will pick back up until 2025, late 2025 into 2026, because the market really needs a lower cost, more affordable EV to entice kind of more new buyers into the market. So long term, I'm very positive. I think this company has done everything right in terms of, you know, looking at AI, looking at AV. I still believe the EV shift has actually sailed. We're going to have EVs for the long terms, and I think that subscription-based, software-based vehicle that they're trying to build is the right move, right strategy for the industry.
Steve, what did Elon say, or to what extent did he address just kind of the developments in China, how things are developing there from a competitive standpoint, a sales standpoint, and all that?
Yeah, it's. I actually see that it will continue to be bumpy. They're probably likely to lose market share, continue to lose some market share there. But I think, you know, Tesla is leveraging China, not just for sales, but it's a low-cost manufacturing base for the company. The Shanghai factory still pumps out a million vehicles, close to a million vehicles a year at a very low cost. They still are able to source battery from companies like CATL, the largest EV battery maker in the world, at a very attractive price given their volume. So, you know, China sales will probably slow. It's a hyper-competitive market. Xiaomi, which is a, you know, a major cell phone maker in China, they're launching a vehicle that's also very affordable. So they're going to see more competition in China. So, but again, China is not just a sales for sales, but it's a manufacturing, low-cost manufacturing base for them.
So something else on the call, Steve, that Elon had took a dig at the car makers that are paring back on the EV production plans and going more to the gas electric hybrids instead. He didn't call them out, but GM and Ford are among those ones. But isn't that really where consumers are going more proportionally right now, more into the plug-in hybrid space or maybe non-plug-in hybrid, but just hybrids in general versus full-on EVs?
Yeah, I think the consumer, I think, you know, we did a survey not so long ago. I think what we got from that survey was that I think the consumer needs to try out EVs. They actually need to be educated on, you know, how to make EV work in their daily life. So, you know, PHEVs, plug-in hybrids is actually a good transition into full EVs. They alleviate some of the concerns in terms of range, in terms of the lack of infrastructure that's for the EV market right now. So PHEV and EV are a good transitional product, but it's not a long-term product, because if you look at some of the emission standards, it's continue to be tighter and tighter. Eventually, hybrids and PHEVs are probably won't even meet the more stringent emission standards down, you know, in the next decade.
Steve, 30 seconds. What's the call here on just Elon? Is he focused on Tesla?
He is focused on Tesla. There was a question last night on that, and he reiterated that, you know, I mean, this is his baby.
Yep.
You know, AI, his baby. I want to say that's his dream.
Yep.
Is to make cars, robots, autonomous. So he's laser focused on that.
All right, good stuff, Steve Mann. Thanks so much for joining us as always. Global Autos and Industrials Research Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us from Princeton, New Jersey, via Zoom here. And the investors certainly liked what they heard last night, Molly.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that stock is ripping today. And hadn't Nora just said, I mean, it was down quite a bit on the year. So this is, the job cuts too have been like really quite something. I mean, our colleagues out in San Francisco, Dana Hall and Ed Ludlow have been all over that.
Yep.
So I think the marketing division, that was the most recent one to go.
Right.
That we've decided that ads are no longer worth it.
Yep.
People are just going to buy the
cars. It's word of mouth. It's word of mouth, and it's the strength of the brand out there. So the stock is up 14%.
I don't know if I really disagree with that.
So anyway, it's got a market cap of $425 billion. So we'll see how this plays out. So a good day for the shareholders of Tesla.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business App. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
I'm Paul Sweeney. We're live in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio, and we're also streaming live on YouTube, so you can head over to YouTube.com, search Bloomberg Podcast, and that's where you'll find us. All right, Facebook. Kids call it Meta.
The
professionals call it Facebook.
Be Facebook for me.
Stock's up 40% year to date. It's up 130% over the last 12 months. So when you see a stock that's had that kind of performance, it sets the bar high.
It's got to be AI. I mean, what else, right?
Yeah, and it means they better really deliver on their earnings, and they're going to report earnings, I think, after the close tonight. So let's get a little preview. Mandeep Singh joins us here, a senior technology analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us here in studio as he does. He does not mail it in from home or from Princeton. He comes into the world capital of
big gold star for that,
as opposed to his management team, which we'll leave that. Mandeep, stocks had a heck of a run here. What do they need to do here with their next earnings report?
Just keep executing. I mean, what they have done over the last 18 months is one, you know, really the focus on cost cuts. And the year of efficiency, which was 2023, has really paid off. So,
AKA job cuts.
I mean, look, I think you could argue with a lot of the tech companies, their cost structure was bloated coming out of the pandemic because they overhired looking at the growth. And so they had to course correct. In the case of Meta, I mean, this is a great business model, over 50%. Operating margin, and for good reason. I mean, the fixed costs are almost negligible after, you know, you have the infrastructure of the scale of what Meta has created, you know, for their family of apps. And so the way I look at it is Instagram clearly still has a ton of runway. The Blue app is losing engagement, but they have been able to make up for that with their Reels product. And Reels was the equivalent of TikTok. Remember, TikTok really was a scary proposition for them in terms of taking away engagement. They managed to create a product that was comparable to TikTok. And now if the TikTok app is banned, that's actually a great positive because they're going to get a lot of the creators come over from TikTok to Reels.
Is that a lot of why the stock has had the run it's on right now because of the prospect of TikTok being banned? Or is it really more the AI story?
It's actually the execution that they have shown over the past 12 months. And as I mentioned, cost cuts have played a big role because now their EPS expectations have gone up 40%. So in their case,
earnings per share,
yeah. It's not just multiple expansion, it's EPS growth expectations have also caught up. And I think in terms of the top line, they've been able to grow top line 25% after laying off 25% of the staff. So that tells you how much leverage there is in the business model. And look, their scale really is what differentiates Meta from like a Snap or a Pinterest. Snap and Pinterest are still struggling with ad pricing. Not so much for Meta because they have the best ad targeting, and that's what gets reflected in their numbers.
All right. So you mentioned the TikTok issue, and again, that legislation, the aid package, $95 billion package signed into law by the president today. Part of it includes TikTok. So we spoke to Matt Schoenholm. He was our litigation analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence yesterday. He says this is going to court. When you talk to investors that invest in Meta, YouTube, all the competitors to TikTok, is there a feeling in the marketplace how this might play out?
Yeah, I think overall it's a net positive for both those companies, I mean, Meta and Alphabet, YouTube, because even if, let's say, the court overturns or decides, you know, the app needs to make some remedies and can still operate, I think TikTok has a tough problem in terms of retaining their creators. So it's one thing, you know, yeah, you've got, you know, viewers who come to your app for content, but ultimately it's the user-generated content that's what makes TikTok unique. And if they lose those creators over to YouTube or to Instagram, then those creators aren't going to come back, even if the app can operate down the line. So in the case of internet, it's all about engagement. And the way you maintain engagement is through unique content, in this case, user-generated content. So they can't afford to lose those creators.
Definitely. Yeah, they drive a lot of views in the ad space for sure.
I wouldn't
sure.
know.
I mean, I'm just taking a guess. I'm not on TikTok. I'm not that young, cool person, but I've heard.
You are young and cool as opposed to John Tucker.
I mean
we're just
low bar
make
there.
The assumption that John Tucker's not on TikTok.
I haven't said anything.
Well, as John
Why
said
are they
before,
on me, man, Dave?
John likes to fly through anonymously through this.
No,
world.
John's
so
a big,
no
John's a big
there.
YouTube guy. He goes on and he you watch the like the professors who teach classes and stuff like that.
Yeah,
you learn
a lot of physics courses.
See?
And you know.
Oh, that's really what YouTube was created for.
Exactly.
anyways, we're gonna keep respond. It moving with Mandeep
let John go.
Here. Thank you, John, for joining us today. So, Mandeep, coming back to Meta here, this is so we've been talking about this stock rally. It's added like you know close to almost $400 billion in market value on this run. But this stock, compared to the peers that you were mentioning, Snap, Pinterest, Reddit, this is cheap. How does that work? Tell us about this earnings multiple and how that's why this stock is trading at a discount.
Well, so large caps always trade at a slightly lower multiple than your small cap companies, and for good reason. You know, there's only so much runway you have as a company that already generates over $150 billion in annual revenue. So, look, I think in the case of Meta, the sentiment, yes, can be positive if they deliver on not only their core business, but also AI. So right now, everyone is focused on what additional revenue you can generate from AI. And in the case of Meta, they were losing $16 billion a year on Metaverse. Now they seem to have made that pivot where they're more focused on AI. They've released a third version of their Llama model, which is what everyone is focused on.
Myself included. Yeah. We have to ask, what is the Llama model? Please tell us.
So in the world of generative AI, it's about having your own foundational model. Think of OpenAI's GPT. What powers ChatGPT is an underlying foundational model where you have got a very large size model with you know, billions of parameters and weights, and that's what makes it intelligent. Now, Meta has actually trained its own model using NVIDIA GPUs, and that is comparable to GPT or you know Google Gemini in terms of performance. So what it tells you is they're not dependent on anybody to deploy their technology, or they don't need to partner. In fact, we did a survey at BI, and Meta emerged as a contender for Gen AI-based search. So think of what ChatGPT is doing or Perplexity is doing. Meta actually is being used as a search platform now because they have rolled out Meta AI on WhatsApp and on Instagram. And over time, maybe they take share from Google search.
And that's what's called Llama?
Llama is the model.
We gotta also know why it's called Llama.
That powers it.
That's okay. Called Silicon Valley.
That Llama model can right. be used for all types of use cases. Search is just one of them.
I'm clearly not an engineer. It's beyond me.
Exactly. Fortunately, Mandeep is, and so we get to chat with him. Mandeep, 30 seconds left. Metaverse, where are we on that? You mentioned that it was at a run rate loss of $16 billion.
As long as they keep growing over 20%, market is forgiving when it comes to losing $4 billion a quarter. They don't care.
And that's still the kind of...
And we don't have any markers.
So he's not backing away from
this. He's not backing away. And we don't have any markers on what he's losing $4 billion on. Maybe he's subsidizing all the VR and the AR glasses that people are buying. And that could be one way you justify that.
I haven't seen... Well, I don't know one single person who's on the metaverse. I couldn't tell you a single thing about it.
No.
And well, I think AR glasses, I think some people, I was talking to Aunt Marie, she owns one of the AR glasses. So there's a few people who...
What do you do with them?
Well, you use it to consume content or to, you know, just like convenience.
John Tucker is laughing here. I think he's amused that I also have no idea what's going on with the metaverse.
Oh, you're in the same boat as I am. Okay. So I'm glad.
All right. Well, just as long, I think for the stock, as long as they don't talk about it, that's good for the stock. Uh-huh. Mandeep Singh, thank you for, again, explaining what's happening in the world of technology. Mandeep Singh, one of the best tech analysts on Wall Street. And he covers all the tech stuff. We've got Anurag Rana also there doing it from a senior perspective. We got technology team all over the globe following technology in Asia, Europe, what is in Europe, and certainly the U.S., Mandeep Singh.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We're live here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio, streaming live on YouTube as well. So check in on YouTube.com and search Bloomberg Podcast. Bloomberg News, along with Morning Consult, they have an ongoing poll where they do some polling data as it relates to the current political situation in key battleground states. That's the key part, right?
It's been a really good series, and Gregory Cordy has been all over it. He's our Bloomberg News White House and political correspondent. And he's going to join us now. Gregory, what can you tell us about the big takeaways from this iteration of the poll?
Yeah, so as you said, we've been doing this every month. This is the seventh iteration of this poll in seven key battleground states. And for the first 5 months, it was a pretty stable race with former President Trump with a slight lead over President Biden. Then after the State of the Union address, we got a little bit of good economic news. And we saw last month, President Biden pretty much bring it even. He was winning or even in the Rust Belt states, the blue wall states, we call them, of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Made it, gave him a fighting chance. But now we're seeing in this month, in the April poll, sort of reversion back to the mean, what we had been seeing all along with former President Trump having, across these seven battleground states, a six-point lead. And that's significant. Biden can't win this without getting at least those blue wall states and probably another one. And he's now down in Pennsylvania by within the margin of error, but significantly down in Wisconsin. Michigan, interestingly, is his bright spot. And who would have known, because there are a lot of concerns there about a large population of Muslim voters, union workers. But he seems to be holding his own there.
Gregory, what are the key drivers or key influencers in this poll? What kind of moves the numbers around?
It's really the economy. And you see that with any incumbent president. Their numbers move up and down with the economy. And what we're seeing in this poll is deep pessimism about where we're going to be by the end of the year. You see here the numbers. Majorities think that the inflation rate is going to be higher by the end of the year, that the economy overall is going to be worse, and also that interest rates are going to be higher by the end of the year. Now, these are voters talking, and they're sort of giving us their perspective within this political framework, where this might differ a little bit from the University of Michigan survey when we're talking to consumers and people making different kinds of decisions. But the fact that President Biden is so tied to the state of this economy and that people are pessimistic about the economy is not a good sign for the president.
This is so fascinating to me as somebody who covers the economy, just like this is something, you know, Gregory, we're no stranger to this, but just like the mismatch in like where the economy is actually performing and how people actually perceive it to be performing. And it's so interesting to me that like this mismatch continues here. I mean, we're about to get a GDP report tomorrow that's going to be, is it tomorrow? Yeah, tomorrow. Okay. Then it's going to be pretty strong. I mean, going to have growth up in near the 2.5-3% area. The unemployment rate is below 4%. Yeah, inflation has been stalling. I guess when you say to me that, you know, a majority of swing state voters see the economy worsening, I just wonder, what metric are they referring to? And I know that they're not looking at the economy based on, we think manufacturing is this, but, what are they looking at? Is it really just inflation?
Yeah, voters look at the economy differently than economists look at the economy. And one of the interesting things, even in this poll, there's an inconsistency, and it's a little inscrutable, but when you ask people about the national economy, two-thirds of them say it's bad. When you ask people about their local economy, a majority say it's actually pretty good. And so people are differentiating between their own personal economic situation and what they see in the economy writ large. Why is that? It may be because of they're keying off of negative political coverage. It might be because we have this political polarization where when they're saying the economy is bad, they're really trying to make a statement about the president who they don't like. It may just be that they view inflation as a national issue and inflation is high. Unemployment they might see as a local issue because they have a job and their neighbor has a job, and so they might see it as a local issue, and so therefore their local economy is doing well. There's a lot to parse out there, but certainly people are giving us mixed signals about the state of this economy.
And what do you think the Biden administration needs to do, perhaps differently, going to Molly's point about saying, hey, the economy is in pretty darn good shape. Here's what we've done. How do you think they should be messaging this?
They have been trying with that message for months now, and it's been a tough message to get across. At one point, they tried to take this pejorative label of the economy that Republicans tried to brand it with, of Bidenomics, and turn that into a positive. That did not work. They did not change the public perception of Bidenomics. They moved a little bit away from that messaging right now. They can talk all they want about the infrastructure bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, the CHIPS Act, all of these things that we know we've been tracking. Is starting to make a difference and will make a difference in manufacturing, onshoring a lot of technology. But those aren't really resonating with people. People don't really connect with bills being passed. They want to see actual stuff getting done. And some of that is on a longer time ramp. So maybe it's just giving it time. We have 6 months now. But the problem for Biden is that now, the second quarter of an election year, is really when people start to make up their minds about the economy, really sort of solidify how they think the economy is, and they're going to carry that with them into November.
And another problem with all this too, Gregory, and that you point out in the story, is that it really doesn't matter, like, for whatever reason that the economy is performing the way it is, but voters' perception is that if it's doing poorly, you put that blame on the president, whether it's, you know, deserves to be there or not. So, and, you know, Biden tried shifting that a bit, you know, saying the inflation stuff is stemming from, you know, Russia's invasion of Ukraine. That message didn't really sit. Can he really shift the blame elsewhere anymore?
Yeah, we asked that very specific question in this iteration of the poll. We asked who is responsible for the economy. And the number one answer, of course, is the president. There is some political polarization there. Republicans are more willing to hold him accountable than Democrats. Democrats are more likely to say, well, you know, Congress also plays a role. The Fed plays a role. Wall Street, corporations all play a role. For Republicans, they want to put this entirely at the feet of the president. So the issue is going to be how do independents see it? How do swing voters see it? Do they give Biden a little bit of a pass, given that this post-pandemic economy has had a whole bunch of struggles that may or may not be outside the president's control? That's the debate that we're going to have in the next 6 months or so.
Gregory, how aware do you think the White House is of polling data like this?
Thank you so much, Simon.
I don't necessarily want to get into every conversation that I have with the White House and the Biden campaign on this, but suffice it to say they're very aware. The public messaging is going to be we don't dictate policy by the way polls are from day to day. But they look particularly at these polls. You'll see a lot of polls out there that have the national number, the popular vote number, and that's actually pretty even. Trump and Biden are pretty much neck and neck in those national numbers, but because of the way the Electoral College is constructed, it's these seven states that are most likely going to decide this, and that's where that six-point differential makes a difference. And so they're looking not just at the national numbers. They would obviously like to see an upward trend in the national numbers, but they're looking state by state by state to see where they're doing, where they're up, where they're down. And this is going to be especially important going in the summer and fall into where they deploy the resources, where they spend money on ads, where they put volunteers on the ground, where they knock on doors, where they do the get out on the vote efforts. And this is going to be a very shifting campaign over the next 6 months. We're going to see both the Trump and Biden campaigns look at these polls and decide where to deploy their resources, because this is actually an awfully small chessboard.
Yep.
This is not a 50-state campaign. This is a 7-state campaign, and maybe even smaller than that at this point.
And Gregory, is there any reason to think in your polling data, do you see anything about the president, former President Trump's legal issues being a weight on him? Doesn't appear to be.
We asked that not this month, but the previous month. We asked whether people would change their minds if the president's convicted on anything. And a majority said that they would not vote for Trump if he were convicted on something. Now, we'll see if he were to be convicted, whether people might change their minds and discount these. Obviously, President Trump is out there every day trying to dismiss these as partisan political persecutions of him. So we'll have to see whether an actual conviction changes that dynamic at all. People really aren't differentiating between these cases at all. The Alvin Bragg case that's going on in Manhattan now, the two federal cases and the Georgia case, people kind of throw them all in the same bucket. And so we'll just have to see if there's an actual conviction, how people process that information.
It certainly is a lot to keep track of from a voter's perspective, so I can't necessarily say I blame them if you do lump them all together. Something else you touched on in this version of the survey, Gregory, is abortion and how important that will be in deciding the next president. How did that one rank versus the economy?
This poll was in the field when we had that Arizona Supreme Court decision that upheld a 19th century abortion restriction law that was in effect up until Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court case in 1973. And so we're reverting back to the pre-Roe law in Arizona, very controversial, obviously. And we do see an uptick of voters saying that abortion is a very important issue for them, and especially, obviously, among Democratic women, among independent women, a little less so, but suburban women is the key demographic that we all look at, an uptick there, and especially in Arizona. Now, the question is going to be whether these are people who already, those votes were baked in, those were votes that President Biden was already going to get. It may help him, though, in terms of enthusiasm. There seems to be an enthusiasm gap here, and so Joe Biden, even if he's not winning any new voters on the abortion issue, he needs that issue to really motivate those Democratic voters to show up in November, because there might be a lot of reasons why they otherwise might decide to sit this one out.
All right, Gregory, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your reporting. Gregory Cordy, White House and political correspondent for Bloomberg News, joining us from Washington, D.C.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Molly Smith, she's sitting in for Alex Steele this week, who's on vacation. I'm Paul Sweeney. We're live here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. We're streaming live on YouTube. That's video. So go over to YouTube.com and search Bloomberg Podcast, and that's where you will find us. You know, Molly, one of the most amazing stories to me in financial services over the last decade or so has been the growth of ETFs.
Huge. Can't ignore it.
Amazed at the fund flows to ETFs, and it makes a lot of sense. And fortunately, we have people like Eric Balchunas at Bloomberg Intelligence who keeps us updated on what's going on there. But we wanted to talk to one of the practitioners in the business. We had Jennifer Grancio joins us. She's Global Head of Distribution at TCW. Little firm on the West Coast, huge firm on the West
Very
Coast.
Very big firm.
And they're into the ETF business. Jennifer, thanks for joining us here in our studio. What is the TCW ETF business? Tell us kind of how you guys are in that business.
Happy to. Great to be here. So from a TCW perspective, a lot of people think of us as, you know, the core of the fixed income portfolio, which we are for many investors with the TCW or MetWest funds. And now we're growing the equity business as well. So a lot of that will be ETFs. And we also are going to do ETFs in the fixed income space.
When you say you do ETFs, are you the one that you're like deciding what goes into each one, or like tell us like what your role is in this marketplace?
Yeah, for sure. So from an equity perspective at TCW, we have some great core strategies we run in mutual funds and SMAs through the Engine Number One acquisition, and then also we're converting a couple of legacy TCW active mutual funds. We're going to have a very impressive range of megatrend thematic products for clients. And if you think about why and what's the role and why does the world need that, there's a lot of index ETF option out there. A lot of people are very indexed in their portfolios, which has this real concentration bias now in large tech. And so we're offering the market a range of ETFs on energy and power transformation, reshoring of supply chains, artificial intelligence, that let you take some money out of the core and really go after outperformance and alpha in your equity portfolio.
So by definition, are those active ETFs?
They are very concentrated portfolios. and active. And if you think about the markets, money's not free anymore.
Right.
Rates are much higher. So we think the next 10, 20 years are a great market for active managers that can outperform. So all of these ETFs on the thematic side will be active.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of those themes. I mean, you had mentioned, you know, related to like energy transition, supply chains. What are some of the ones that you guys are really paying a lot of attention to right now?
Yeah, I mean, those are two big ones. And they're not small, tactical, narrow trends. They're huge. They're going to be here for many decades. And so one of the ETFs is NETZ, N-E-T-Z, and that's about energy and power transformation. And so if you think about that, we are going to need to more than double our power and energy in the next 20 years. So think about that, more than double. And so companies that are at the forefront of how we service the need and demand and kind of monster demand we have for power, as well as companies that are more efficient, have a huge opportunity to outperform. And so that's a big theme. And now in that theme, we own companies that are better energy producers. We own Vertiv, which cools data centers. We own waste and garbage companies that are finding ways to create natural gas and energy out of landfill. So it's a very diverse portfolio and very complementary and different than what you might hold in an index fund.
When I started my equity research business way, way back in the day, it starts with an eight, you know, back in the 80s, we covered railroads.
Hot topic, really.
We wrote the first research report on Consolidated Railroad, which the government, US government, was privatizing via an IPO. We wrote about a 200-page report on that, owned that stock for years.
You want to give us a nice summary of that right now?
Yeah, it was a great cost-cutting thing, taking railroad crews from 5 to 2, tripled your margins.
And the other big trend is supply chain.
That's it. So I know you've got an ETF on railroads. That's why I bring it up. Mm-hmm. Is that, again, I think about the railroads and supply chain. I guess we all got really smart about supply chains and the delicate nature of supply chains during the pandemic. How do you guys think about that?
Yeah, so the sort of reshoring of supply chains and manufacturing to America and North America is, again, it's a monster trend. It started during COVID. So if I'm Deere and I'm trying to make a tractor and my bolt is made in Asia, I couldn't get my bolt. It was really bad for business. So we're seeing that trend already having started. And then on top of that, we've now got geopolitical issues that make us more nervous about doing things like semiconductors outside of the U.S. So again, huge, very broad, multi-sector trend. And what we own in SUP, or the reshoring of supply chain ETF, is all the way from railroads. So how are we going to transport things if we're manufacturing all over North America? It's fantastic for railroads, and they've been undervalued. So that's a big performance opportunity. And early in the cycle, where I think we have $3 trillion of committed projects of new manufacturing, more than we've ever had in the U.S., early in the cycle, we invest a lot in what we call picks and shovels. Mm-hmm. So Martin Marietta, Vulcan, companies that make materials. So as we build all of these factories, and then we own a lot of semiconductor names as well, because all of these factors are going to have AI and robots, and they have much higher demand for content from a semiconductor perspective.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the AI theme next. That's certainly got to be a big one of these thematic trends that you're focusing on. So how are you positioning around AI right now?
Yeah, so in the case of AI, it's in those two portfolios to some extent. And then we have a mutual fund at TCW, which we're converting to an ETF. So watch the space for that.
What's the advantage of that? Is it just like, you know, I guess because ETFs tend to be a bit cheaper for like a more consumer-friendly product? Is that the idea?
Yeah, in this case, it's an active fund. So it's not a sort of a cheap index fund. But the argument, and why I think you see a lot of active managers converting where it makes sense, is that the market likes ETFs. It likes the ability to click through and see the underlying holdings on the website. It likes the tax advantages of an ETF. And so in the case of these megatrends, we see the market in general buying ETFs, not funds. So we have a very long track record on the TCW Artificial Intelligence Fund, and we're converting it to an ETF. Yeah. And a little bit like what we talked about in the case of NETZ or in SUP, the AI fund has an ability to invest in different things as we move through time. So it's not all big tech. It's also systems and enablers and hardware that is going to grow aggressively as all these companies are doing more in AI.
So it's safe to say you guys at TCW are big believers in AI?
We are.
Okay, because I guess my skeptical sell-side analyst nature is like, where did this come from? Is this just big data from 3 or 4 years ago? Is this just big tech is growing as a percentage of GDP of 20 years ago? What's new about AI?
I think we're in the next evolution of training systems, asking systems questions with all these models and natural language models, asking questions in a way that we just get faster and faster and better output.
Yep.
And so that's good for everyone. And so it'll start slowly, but as more people learn to get that leverage, I think we're going to see. Because you're going to see a boom.
Yep, and it's we hear every company in the S&P 500 on their conference calls talking about AI and how it's going to be critical to their business. Jennifer Grancio, thanks so much for joining us. Jennifer is the global head of distribution for TCW. We appreciate her coming into our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio in New York City.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/FutureInvestor/radio.